right.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning.
The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Oops. I'm supposed to let that paper noise go in the microphone. Good morning. It is the Real World Money Show. We do it every Wednesday here on One Radio Network. We're live 9 to 11 or so, depending on if we can keep Andy in the booth for after 11 if we got a lot of stuff. And our phone number, if you care to join us, is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Andrew Goss is a currency historian. He's a nationally recognized one at that. He's written a couple of books, Secret World of Money and Uncle Sam Cooks the Books, and working on a third, The Monetary History of the United States. He buys and sells gold coins for a living. And since 1997, been speaking with Andy on the radio about once a month, and then beginning in 2007, once a week. And he's given me quite an education. I think after all my 20 years of talking with you, Andrew, I'm just going to, let's see. I don't really have a plan is the problem, because knowing what I know about the monetary system,
yes.
You know, I think the only thing to do is go to Belize, get some gold, and plant a garden.
So yeah, I mean, accumulate. Don't speculate.
Accumulate, yeah. And don't speculate. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Boy, I wish I would have met you when I was about 17 and said, Patrick, why don't you buy a little bit of gold every month for the next rest of your life? And I'd be on some island, you know, drinking drinks with little umbrellas in them, Andrew Goss. Yeah, you know what I mean? Jelly
bean? Yeah. The future would be financially secure anyway.
Yeah. This idea of just currency just kind of just is amazing once we understand it, how you've been able to teach us. Venezuela. You got to love this. Venezuela, it's like a socialist dream, right? It once had gold, it once had oil in abundance, and now today people are literally starving. Their toilet paper costs worth more than, you've heard this story, right? More than the money itself. The IMF has got most of its gold, right? And Switzerland got a lot of its gold because they owed Switzerland money. They bought a lot of their bonds. Good for Switzerland. And now oil is being leveraged for future production just to keep them going. And Maduro did his crypto petro oil thing to try to get people to buy his oil. And that's not going well. President Trump said, no, you can't even do that. It's against the law. You can't buy that petro. So the first quarter in 2018, you want to guess what the inflation was in Venezuela? Andrew Goss, currency historian, man about town. Do you want to guess?
500%.
Wow. 454%.
Yeah.
8,900% inflation in the past 12 months on the Bolivar.
Right.
How is that even possible?
Well, it's possible if you're... If you're a deficit spending government, you spend money that you don't have, and to make it up, you just print more.
But everybody does that.
Yeah, but apparently Venezuela's leading the pack.
No, I see. They're
number one.
Now, so the difference between the United States, which money gets printed, and it's a little different way, and Venezuela, when they go short dollars, Venezuela, I think, just prints their Bolivar. They don't allow the Fed to print it like we do here and borrow it.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
Yeah. Which is a little smarter than what we do.
Right. Except that nobody in the world will take their currency.
Yeah, so that's a problem.
That is a problem.
That's a problem. So they're literally just not taking care of any basic issues and having a hard time doing this petro thing for the oil, and I saw where they wanted to give a 30% cut in their oil price if people like India uses the petrol.
Yeah, they're just trying to create demand for this cryptocurrency that they've issued, the petrol.
Yeah. they have about access to 25% of the world's heavy crude, mm-hmm. but they have to import a lot of this diluted stuff to make the crude work because it's so thick and gooey down there. Is that right?
That's right. It's not that light, sweet Nigerian crude.
The light, sweet crude. Wow. They have $6 billion in gold left, and that's it. And,
yeah.
So this socialist, can we blame it on the socialist model, or does Maduro just have a big bank account in the Caymans and places like that, in Panama and Switzerland, and he's just stealing all the money, or
no?
It's just the model doesn't work.
Well, no, the world's banking system has decided to crush Venezuela.
So, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
See, I just miss the big picture sometimes.
Yeah.
So the boys, the bankers, yeah. the people, mm. the elite, and why yes. do they? What do they got? You know, what's their problem with Maduro? I mean, what do they care?
Your own central bank. What's the matter with you?
Oh, well.
You need an independent central bank. That's the biggest mistake. And it wasn't him. It was the guy before him. You remember
Hugo. Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, Hugo had him on the ropes, man.
How come?
Well, he was actually making progress towards...
Making it work, right?
Yeah,
making it work.
And getting the other countries of South America to recognize that you're a slave to the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
And, you know, mm-hmm. the sooner we get these guys off our backs, mm-hmm. the better we'll be.
Ooh, get off my back.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah. So he got it, that your premise over these many years here, that why borrow money from the bankers who print the money, like the ECB, the IMF, the Federal Reserve, and the rest of them, just go ahead and print your own.
Yeah, well, I don't want to steal the credit from Mayor Amschel Rothschild.
Oh, you might, though, because
he said,
Rothy was pretty cool.
Give me the power to coin a nation's money, mm-hmm. and I care not who makes its laws.
Oh, you know,
it doesn't matter.
He did have quite a bit of wine before he said that, though. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
yeah.
And he really did care who made the laws.
Uh-huh.
But I think his point was that if he has the power to create the money, then he can influence the lawmakers by creating money for them. And this is, of course, the role that the Federal Reserve takes in the United States.
It just seems like such an obvious duh moment of allowing the private bankers to create the money that it just amazes me that it ever got done.
Well,
you know, I mean, it's just, isn't it? I mean, why would you do, you know, you said it, what, if you had a magic checkbook and you could write, you know, go
right.
ahead and say the allegory you use.
Yeah, instead of writing the checks, you have a magic checkbook.
Right, a little magic checkbook. Yeah.
People accept your checks as though they were money.
Yeah.
So you don't they don't have to cash them. They just pass them amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, how many would you write? But the more important point is, would you write those checks yourself? Or would you pick a friend, hand him the checkbook and say, here, write checks and loan me the money. I'll pay you interest. It seems absurd.
It's really kind of absurd. I mean, it's so obvious that even a... Well, I don't know if the millennials these days, I shouldn't kid them, but you know, I mean, it just seems so obvious that why would anybody do that? I mean, how did the bankers, the elite, get so, the dumb question of the day, get so much power over these guys, you know? I mean,
well, they bought them. Mark Twain said, we have the best legislature money can buy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true. There was no doubt that the people that voted to grant the Federal Reserve these sweeping powers were influenced by monetary contributions. Now it's very clear, 100 and some odd years.
It was that clear.
Yeah. Oh. In the 1820s and 30s, it wasn't as clear. But the members of Congress in the First Bank of the United States and the Second Bank of the United States were offered a piece of the profits if they would just go along. That was really all they had to do.
You've told us George Wooden Teeth Washington and mm-hmm. Hamilton, right?
Yeah, the Grand Bargain, right?
Oh, is that called the Grand Bargain?
Well, sure. You know, George owned a lot of swampland on the Potomac River.
Did he now?
Yeah. And he wanted to put the nation's capital there.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamilton said, well, that's easy. Just give me that central bank I'm looking for. And we'll make sure you get your Washington, D.C.
Really?
So that
Why would George give away the whole enchilada, as they said in JFK, the whole enchilada? Why would he give away the whole enchilada? I mean, he must have had an ego the size of Delaware.
Well, George was heavily in debt.
Was he?
Yeah, he was cash poor.
Oh.
And having the ability to now sell lots in Washington, D.C.
We're going to subdivide this dude.
Yeah, that was his motivation.
That's great.
He did a lot of work for the country, He felt he was entitled to some kind of compensation.
Yeah.
And this seemed like the perfect way to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So the others would have rather had the capital and federal city there outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah, that was a runner-up, right?
Yeah, or anywhere else. But this swamp in Northern Virginia, that's what it was. It was low-lying, mosquito-infested, and no use other than the nation's capital.
And it remains a swamp today.
Oh, yeah.
It just stayed right there. It's all swampy. It's still swampy to this day. It's still swampy today. How's President Trump doing on cleaning up the swamp? Still a lot of mosquitoes and stuff? What's your take?
Yeah. Well,
Is he really getting rid of some of the swamp boys or not? What do you think?
He drains one area and another one fills up. So these guys are entrenched, man. 240-odd years, they've got their mark on the city, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard for one man to undo it all, but he's doing his best. He is angering them at every turn.
So it's just like a giant squid. You just cut off one leg and then another one just pops up kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Now, Steve Mnuchin's in China this week trying to hammer out a deal with those folks. And, now of course, we have Angela Merkel.
She she was frowny the whole time, man. She was she was pouting the whole time. Did you see the look on her?
She should have been.
She says, Donald, I'm not sure about you. What's up with you?
But we should take a page from Angela Merkel's playbook, or shall we say the German playbook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what they do in Germany is the employers get together with academia and say, hey, you know, we need 1,000 machine operators. And so then the colleges there, the apprentice schools, teach kids how to have these skills that business needs.
Do they?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. So that'd be nice if we implemented that sort of a program here, where the manufacturers in the United States tell the institutions of higher learning, hey, stop teaching them Shakespeare and start teaching them how to run this machine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you might actually fix the employment problem, which right now is too many jobs and not enough people to fill them. How ironic is that?
That's crazy, isn't it, when you think about it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the ADP numbers were a little punky that came out, what, today or yesterday, but you had said off the air, you said, well, that's kind of good because this is going to be a problem for Mr. Trump and his wall stuff and the whole immigration thing, because they're arguing now that, well, we just don't have enough workers anyway. You gotta
let them in.
So is that the globalist big reason why they have so much disdain for the president and his wall thing? They just want these people in to pay them a lower,
lower
money or what?
Yeah, there's that.
Mm-hmm.
There's that, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The jobs that Americans don't want.
Yeah, you've always said that one. Yeah. The jobs that Americans don't want.
Right, but I don't believe that. What's more offensive to them is, we put in all the environmental worker safety regulations in the 70s, which made it very expensive to manufacture anything in the United States.
Sure, yeah.
You had to have clean emissions in your air and, couldn't dump stuff in the water, and you had to keep the land clean, and you had to offer a safe workspace for your employees.
Healthcare?
Yeah, well, there's a whole long list of benefits, so which made manufacturing in the United States quite expensive.
Yeah.
And so those free traders decided that they would thwart or bypass all of those regulations by moving their factories to places that didn't have such rules, and then exploit the workers there, pollute the environment there, ignore the EPA regulations here.
No tariffs because free trade and NAFTA. So they did. So that all happened, Andrew, 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now they found a way, okay, we put these regulations in place, no problem.
Yeah.
We're just going to move our factories to a place where we don't have to follow these regulations.
Yeah.
And then we'll import our goods back into the United States with no tariffs, free trade, right? So it allowed the big corporations to bypass the entire regulatory framework that was put in place with the EPA.
But they didn't really, or they must have thought that this free trade NAFTA thing was going to be forever and ever.
Right.
Right, because why would you, you know, pack up and go to Mexico or wherever? That's a huge expense, right?
Sure it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look at some of the metrics there, those costs were recouped rather quickly.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, both in, you know, starvation wages that they were paying to their employees and a complete lack of environmental protection and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things combined made it cheaper in many instances to move your factory to offshore rather than retrofit it to meet the new regulations.
So do you think the idea of a lower corporate tax rate is going to be enough incentive for an Apple, say, to start spending some money here? Of course, there's no workers, so what are they going to do?
Right. Yes. Well, a company like Apple, who's environmentally conscious to begin with, they say.
They say.
Mm-hmm. They say. Yeah.
But of course, well, they don't follow through with that, with the workers and all the conditions and all that, and where they build the stuff, right?
Remains to be seen. They don't do it now.
I've heard some torrid tales about that.
Yes, indeed.
I don't
know
if it's fake news or what. You know.
I don't know what it is either.
Yeah.
But you have some really oppressive working conditions in some of the subcontractors that supply Apple components.
I mean, we saw pictures, actually, of nets.
Yeah.
Nets where people, it was so terrible and their conditions, they were jumping off the, out of the window, so they put nets there.
Yes, it's
That's not good. That's not good iPhone karma, you know.
No, it isn't good iPhone karma. And so for me, whenever I encounter anyone who's anti-tariff or free trade, I ask them what they expect us to do, because there are two answers to the problem. And one is that we dismantle all of our regulations so that our businesses can be competitive again.
Well, they've been doing a bit of that, and the lefties are all...
Panners, and they should be.
Panners, and they should be. I mean, if you're going to pollute the air more and all that, I would
and
be.
And the water more.
And the righties should be not happy about it either.
Yeah, but there are many righties who believe that, oh, we're just over-regulating American business, and if we just cut down on regulation, they could compete a lot easier.
Right. Of course, we don't really know the truth about the minutiae of how much mercury gets released and all, you know, the new regulations. Who knows that? Who reads that stuff?
Yeah, right.
I mean, nobody knows.
But at least we're trying. We're trying
to
make a safer environment so that manufacturers aren't allowed to simply pollute at will for profit.
Yeah, yeah.
And once you dismantle that framework, then there is nothing except the corporate conscience to prevent it. And I'm not for that. As much as I lean right, you know, the idea that we're going to dismantle all these hard-fought regulations.
That's not right.
Just so that we can be competitive? Let's force the rest of the world to adopt the same regulations that America's manufacturers have to.
Now you're talking.
Then we can compete. You know, then it's a level playing field.
But can a president do that with the tariff things and the chutzpah that old President Trump has, you know, theoretically with these people?
Well,
can he get that done?
With these bilateral trade agreements.
Right,
so
that's what he wants. Tell folks what that is. That's interesting. Bilateral.
Well, it's essentially, you make a deal. We make a deal with Canada.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or we make a deal with England.
Right.
Or we make a deal with France.
Right.
But we're forced into these multilateral trade agreements, like the TPP or NAFTA, where it just covers everyone and everything.
Just not right, is it? It doesn't work.
You can't buy your suit that way. You know, you have to at least buy it in your size, a suit that fits you. There's no one size fits all.
But you're a money dude, right? You're a money dude. So how do you do it big picture when you have everything's pegged to the dollar? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, everything is pegged to the dollar.
And that's right.
You've told us why that happened, and it's a big deal. It's the reserve currency. How do you do that when there's so much difference in their value? I mean, even Kuwait, 347
Yeah.
You know, one Kuwaiti dinar is worth $3.47.
Right.
I mean, what's up with that? You know, and then you go to Vietnam. It's 0.00004 dong per dollar.
Correct.
You know, how do you deal with that?
Well, from the globalist perspective, the answer is a one world currency.
Oh, well, good.
That's good in every nation of the world. And no more of this nationalistic idea of having individual currencies.
But you've told us that that idea has always been, let's have the dollar be the one world currency.
Well, that's what we tried after Bretton Woods in 1945, after World War II.
Oh, you mean
War
you got to sell your oil for dollars and stuff like that, yeah.
And you know, it wasn't necessarily regulated. It was simply best practice. If you're going to run a trade surplus and you have extra money, you don't want to store it in your local currency or in someone else's currency. You want to store it in gold or its equivalent. And that was the dollar from 1945 until President Nixon closed the gold window in 1971. So for that whole time, we were trading on the ability of the rest of the world to store our dollars. And that created a demand for them that allowed the Federal Reserve to create them willy-nilly. They needed it.
They wouldn't do that, those willy-nilly kind of guys.
Yeah, they did.
If you'd like to be on the show, patrick@oneradionetwork.com is email. And telephone number, 888-663-6386. So, one world currency notwithstanding, then the only way you deal with the disparity between like a dong or a yuan or even a euro and the dollar is tariffs.
Tariffs, yeah.
Is that right? That's the only way you could really, as offset. President Trump said, level the playing field.
Correct.
Is that right? Is that right?
That's what I believe, yeah.
But how does that move? I mean, these prices change, and you have a 25% on steel or something, and then it's tough. I mean, I knew a lady who was buying products from Italy, for example, because she had this company, and she had to buy tomatoes and stuff like that from Italy. So as the euro went up and down wonky, her business model just got really screwy.
Sure.
It was tough, you know. I mean, it went from like 160 or something, and 2 years later it might be 120 for the euro. How do you deal with that?
Well, the same way you would deal with it. Let's say you're an oil company,
yeah,
and you're selling oil prepaid. You know, you put oil in your tank for the winter, and we're gonna sell it to you now. You pay for it when you get it, but we're gonna fix the price today. So what do you do? Well, you go out and you buy an option or a future or a contract on heating oil and lock in your price. So if I were a person that was doing that very same business and my profits relied on the value of the euro, then I would have to go into the foreign exchange markets and cover my hedge, my bet. You know, I'd buy some euro or buy an option or a contract to buy euro. Mm-hmm. So that I could cover my exchange rate risk. Mm-hmm. Most business people aren't Forex traders. You know, they just want to price their goods and be done. But you're right, without compensating for that differential, you could wind up at the end of the year losing money. And if you look at it in the context of the oil crisis of the 70s, so I knew a gas station owner in the late 70s who had this problem. He filled up his tank at the beginning of the month. And he started selling his oil, and the price of oil all through the month kept steadily rising.
During the inflationary times.
He's selling his gas. Right. And when he sold the last gallon of gas, and now it was time to fill up the tank again, he didn't have enough money. The price of the last gallon of gas was much higher than the price of the first gallon of gas. So now he could buy less gas than he bought the month before. And that leads to shortages and the sort of constriction that we experienced from 77 to 80. And you know what, Patrick? I just have this feeling in my bones that we're heading for this again. You know,
inflation.
Oh, the kind that we had before.
In the 70s. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that this morning. Okay, Andrew Gause, Patrick Timpone, if you'd like to be on the show, join us, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Lots to talk about. We're going to see if Mr. Gause understands or has an idea how the money is involved in this whole Iran thing. There are places like Japan and the ECB are actually slowing the amount of money that they're printing and borrowing. What's up with that? One of the oldest banks in the country, Deutsche Bank, is we've been talking about for 3 or 4 years. They're having a problem more. Pensions, we'll talk about, and how this all relates to you and what your dollar may be worth a year from now. If you have particular things to ask Mr. Goss, he's not a financial advisor or an accountant or anything like that, or an attorney, but he has some pretty interesting ideas with his big view of money about mortgages, about rents, about starting your own business and stuff like that. He's helped a lot of people just with his theories. He's, once again, not a professional at it. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com, 888-663-6386. Good morning. It is May 2nd, 2018. Previously with Daniel Vitalis, we were talking about, pine pollen.
Pollen is essentially the equivalent of what an animal would have as sperm. Pollen is like the male part, the semen. And it fertilizes the ovum of the flower, which becomes eventually a fruit. And so if we were going to draw the equivalence, it would be like that the flower is like the female sex organ and the pollen is like the male sexual ejaculate. Well, pine trees, which sort of just dominate so much of the landscape of North America and so much of the world, pine trees, they're semen. They dust the landscape in pollen. And that pollen, being the sort of male part of the plant, has some correspondences to male physiology in our species and many other animal species. So what I'm saying is pine pollen contains all of these different anabolic or androgenic hormones, plant versions of hormones that we need, like testosterone, like DHEA.
Well, the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees, good stuff, guys, and for you girls, too. Several choices of pine pollen. Any Survival Link, OneRadioNetwork.com. Yeah, you betcha. $9.95 is the price, so we can sell you our Relax Far infrared sauna if you live in the contiguous United States. And if you live outside there, email me as well. You have to email me for the $9.95 price, but also email me if you live outside and we'll give you a good deal. We ship them all over the world with the proper plug. Those of you around the world who don't have the kind of plug we have, we have the right one. You guys just have a weird one. Just kidding. And we'll give you the right plug. It ships right from Taiwan with a medical university where they created these guys. It's won some top awards for their technology. Now, the healing light of the far infrared sauna is actually more powerful than the actual sweating. I so much talk about this sweating because we humans, we like to see things come out and say, oh, man, that's good. And it is good. It's a great thing. Trust me, but the healing light going in there and really working with the molecules, restructuring the water in your cells and all of that stuff, that's what's really happening. And then you get to sweat as a bonus too, which removes toxins from the fat. So there you have it. It's a $9.95 deal, and you can just email me and we'll send it to you. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Go to our sauna page. We have some new pictures up there. You'll see what it looks like. All the benefits, extremely low EMFs. This is really, I think it's the best sauna out there. If I was going to just buy one new today and I looked around, this is the one I'd buy. I would, because it's the most cost effective, and I think it works better than all of them. Those wooden guys that cost $5,000. Give me an email and I'll work it out with you. Previously on our show, we talked to the now legendary Dr. Dietrich Klinghardt. And he mentioned sulfur. He's a fan.
The conditions in our world and our environment are changing so dramatically that people need to have a whole host of self-help tools and methods. Mm-hmm. And I'm very thrilled about your version of MSM. It's a right way to go. You know, sulfur is part of most of the detox enzymes, and the critical part that is right now we have a much, much higher need of healthy sulfur than we had even 10 years ago. And so I followed your work a little bit, you know, that you're on the right track with what you are promoting.
Well, Dr. Klinghardt, we've heard from thousands of people over the year how they really love this product. You can click and order our Pure Sulfur, three prices, United States, Canada, and worldwide right here, or email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, for a discount for more than 4 pounds. Pure Sulfur, one of the few places where you can get this product. OneRadioNetwork.com. Be careful, you might get cuter because it really works on hair, skin, and nails. So if you don't want to increase the population, you better be, you know, just kind of, you know. It's, sulfur plays a critical role in detoxification. We talked with Judy Hoy yesterday. She's talking about the glyphosates up in the northwest. If you haven't heard that interview, you got to do it. You can't believe some of the things going on with the glyphosates. And she talked also about the sulfur mechanism that it screws up and doesn't allow the body and the animals, the four-leggeds and the people, to detoxify stuff. So it's pretty critical. Many people get enough, I guess, or think they can from all the sulfur-bearing foods and, you know, go for that. But if you'd like to hedge your bets, try some of the sulfur. It's pure, costs more than most of them, but it's the real deal. There's nothing else in there except pure sulfur. And you can just go on our website and check it out.
Know the source. One Radio Network. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Alrighty, here we are, May 2nd, 2018, with Andrew Goss, currency historian. So, I think, you know, you may be on some, well, you, obviously you know what you're talking about, I have no idea, but I've been reading a little bit about the European Central Bank and Japan, and they're actually, according to what I've read, they're actually beginning to slow, and they have been for a while. Their different bond purchases in their QE and their expansion of the money supply. So are they feeling possible inflation? And did they get together Davos and said, let's kind of chill a little bit here with all this money printing?
Well, they're going to run until September, purchasing at least $30 billion a month.
Oh, you're talking about the Treasury?
No, the ECB.
Oh, the ECB. They're still doing $30 billion a month.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, until September is the latest announcement. Mm-hmm. So I think monetary easing, quantitative easing, is here to stay.
Isn't that a nice word?
Yeah, the Fed is going to make their rate decision today, and I don't think they're going to raise interest rates today, but they will next month, and two more times after that this year. So, and if you think about what that means, so we go from 0 to 2% at Fed funds, and maybe the prime rate will raise to 5%. And so if you're a small business, you'll be paying 6 or 7%, a couple points over prime for money. Even if it's 3 or 4 points, so what are we talking about? 8%. And you can make plenty of money with 8% money. So historically, we're at these very, very low interest rates. And just to get back to normal, interest rates have to double. So I think you'll see much more of that as the year goes on.
So... talk to us like we're a young child, golden retriever. So the whole idea is to balance the interest rates, the money supply, you know, the easing, what they call easing printing of money, and just keep the ship floating without somebody falling off and get eaten by you know who.
The many sharks.
That's right.
Circling this
so that's
boat.
The dance they do, right?
That's it. It's that's a very fine line that they walk.
And every now and then I think about what you said about 2008 when we first started this show, this particular show, and looking back, and how if they didn't do what they did, and
like it would be over. Yeah,
like the movie, the what's the name of it? The movie Too Big to Fail. It was all about Tonight. They wouldn't have done that. We'd all be just, I don't know, what would we be doing?
Tumbleweeds blowing in the
tumbleweeds,
streets.
Tumbleweeds, really?
Yeah, well, the deflationary depression. Well, the deflationary depression is no fun because as the supply of money dwindles, there's not enough to pay everyone's bills. So the problem that we had in 2008 is the same problem that we're facing today, only with bigger numbers. There was three times as much debt as there was money to pay.
That's when the Lehman thing all happened, the mortgage-backed securities, the whole TARP thing.
Right.
President Obama was just coming in, right?
So all of those, all of the property that was thrown on the market would have multiplied. And so naturally, with so many people being foreclosed upon, couldn't pay their bills, so much property being sold, the value of property would have fallen, which would have dragged more people in. And then factories close and jobs disappear. And it's just redux in 1929, the sort of deflationary depression that we went through then. That was my bet then, that they wouldn't allow a deflationary depression, that they would prefer an inflationary period. And that's what I believe that they chose. So they've added, goodness, trillions. Can't even count it anymore. Well,
about $4 trillion, right? Yeah. Just for the Fed, right?
Right.
Tell folks, $4 trillion to their balance sheet. So they've created $4 trillion on their Dell X5P10008Q computer, which is a good computer.
Yeah.
So the money's good. and they bought stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Instead of allowing these assets to diminish in value, mm-hmm. they simply printed the money mm-hmm. and bought them.
Just buy
and stuffed the vaults at the Federal Reserve Bank with virtual treasury bills, bonds, and notes, and mortgage-backed securities, mm-hmm. as well as agency debt, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Sally Mae, and so forth.
So that's when we say $4.5 trillion on their balance sheet, it's just debt.
Right.
Notes that they bought with money that they created. With make-believe money, right?
Yes. Oh. And so now, of late, the Fed has said that they're going to be redeeming these notes and not issuing new ones. I personally don't believe them, and I check the H41 balance sheet on a weekly basis to see if I can find some evidence of the total factors affecting reserves being reduced, and I just don't see it. It's continually growing.
Hmm. So, and you know, don't you think it's curious too, to this day, that this whole 2008 thing 10 years ago, it was still called the subprime crisis. I mean, they really did, and they continue to blame it on people who bought more house than they can afford.
Correct.
Yeah.
Not the case.
Yeah. Not the case, really. I mean, the mortgage-backed securities, of course, were a big deal.
That's what killed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's because they bet, and then they bet again, and then they bet again, and they had insurance and all that.
Yeah, right? It's like allowing people to buy fire insurance on your house.
Yeah.
You know, insuring it for more than the value. Mm. So that's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. That's the way it happened. And so when all these mortgage-backed securities went bad, then the insurers, in this case it was
AIG,
yes, among many others, just were unable to cover all of the insurance that they had written. And so they were forced with the asking hat in hand for a bailout.
And then where did Dick Foltz, the Lehman guy, how did he screw up again? Refresh?
Yeah, well, he bought property.
Oh, he was just buying property.
Yeah, he was buying it like it was going out of style. Trophy properties in London and in Paris. Yeah.
And they were all going down in value.
Sure, yeah. Well, and the inability of the firm. He tied up all the firm's capital in these trophy properties, which were later just sold at a fire sale.
I see, yeah.
So wiping out the equity of the firm.
And don't you love Warren Buffett's deal that he got? Tell folks what that is in case they're new to the show. This is, I know it's 10 years ago, but it's pretty curious. I mean, how the boys kind of get when you're playing cards with them. What did he get? The deal?
Well, yeah, he got the deal of a lifetime, really. He gave $5 billion to
J.P. Morgan. Yeah, good for him.
And
that's nice. Excuse me for interrupting, but isn't it kind of nice when you got $5 billion in your checking account?
Yeah, hey, let me write you a check.
How many zeros is that? Years ago, zero. Okay, go ahead.
Need bigger checks.
Go ahead. So he wrote $5 billion to J.P. Morgan.
And he essentially got the same thing that the Treasury got several months later for half the money, half the price. So
explain to us what he did.
Well, his rate of return was double what the federal government was given. And then he was given warrants, just like the federal government was given. But only he exercised his and took the profits. We forgave ours. We're blaming JP. I think it was Goldman Sachs that had.
So he bought mortgage-backed securities?
No, he just bought equity.
He bought equity in
The bank.
In the bank.
Yep.
And I thought it was, well, could have been either one, but it's usually Goldman, Goldenmy Slacks are the ones that we always pick, and we're generally right, right? And so he bought them, and then he then sold them how much later?
Oh, goodness, yeah. He doubled his money in just a few trading years. So
from $5 to $10 billion.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Pretty good day at the office for old
and
Warren.
And the same size stake that the government bought, they paid, again, twice as much for.
And they didn't get the deal.
They didn't get Warren's deal. Mm-hmm. And they most certainly should have. And then later on, as the company started to improve, especially in the case of Goldman Sachs, the federal government held warrants for Goldman Sachs stock, which they effectively gave away for nothing.
Oh, good.
Instead of taking the profit and putting it in the treasury. It was almost as if they didn't want to make any money off of this. And I think we the people should have, because we the people suffered. So anyway, they took their entire position and gave it back for essentially what they paid, and that we got our money back.
And how did we? How did we, the people, suffer?
Well, because we should have gotten twice as much money. Yeah. We should have made a profit, an enormous profit, but we chose not to. We chose to instead just give the warrants back to Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, yeah. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone. It is the real world of money. If you'd like to see a really fun kind of expose drama about the 2007-8 thing, I recommend the movie The Big Short.
Sure.
They really explain to you, right?
Great movie.
They really explain to you how it all went down and all that. Would you like to hear what Mr. Mnuchin had to say?
No. Yes, I would.
Okay. Yeah. So here's old Steve, and he wasn't producing movies today, so he thought he would do an interview with Bloomberg. Here he is.
We have a quarterly refunding announcement this week. We've already seen that the first quarter of this year was record borrowing by the Treasury. Now, are you concerned that we're now looking at a lot of factors putting the Treasury market in a very different place this year from last year?
No, I think the good news is the U.S. Treasury market is the most liquid and robust market in the world. And while I won't comment on interest rates because I respect the independence of the Fed, what I will say is the market, the forward curve, expects interest rates to go up. How much it goes up and how fast it goes up, we'll see whether it's more or less than the market predicts. But part of the reason why we see interest rates going up is because we've created economic growth. That's a good thing. So we've been focused on targeting 3% sustained GDP. And part of the reason why interest rates have backed up is because of that economic growth.
But Bob Michael, the head of fixed income for JP Morgan Asset Management, he said on Bloomberg this morning he'd never seen as bad demand and supply conditions in the Treasury market, with so much supply coming on, and also central banks, the Federal Reserve, others running down their balance sheets. So many things coming together.
Well, let's just say again, it's a very large, robust market. It's the most liquid market in the world. And there is a lot of supply, but I think the market can easily handle it.
I think just when we think about what are the potential bumps on the road that you could have in terms of the global economy or markets, you know, there's always been a lot of concern about how this more normal monetary policy was going to play out in the long term, in long-term yields. You see yields going to 3%. We saw markets responding to that. For you, is there a danger level that you think of? It's not 3, but is it 4? What would worry you in terms of really causing a pressure in the financial markets?
Well, let me just say, I have tremendous confidence in Chairman Powell and his leadership at the Fed. And again, lots of these issues are interrelated. It depends on where inflation is, it depends on where growth is, it depends on where unemployment is. There's lots of issues that are all interrelated, I'm sure, as they look at monetary policy.
He's a pretty smart guy. He's not going to step in it, you know?
Oh, no.
No, no.
Not going to trip him up.
No, he's a pretty smart guy, right?
Yeah, he is. Very smart.
What was he? Was he a Goldenmy Slacks guy? Mnuchin?
Yes, yeah, he was.
Was he?
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh.
I think everybody was. Anybody who's anybody was Goldman Sachs.
Well, the only I don't think Zuckerberg was yet, but I'm sure he'll.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure he'll get on the board someday. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone. It is the real world of money. If you'd like to join the show, please do. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. To parrot my dear anti-Fed buddy, the dollar ain't federal, And for sure, I ain't got no reserves. Keep an eye out for them commies. They're everywhere you want to be. This guy, what are you
doing? Man, one thing then another.
One thing then
well,
another.
Well, for me, I just don't believe the Federal Reserve notes are an appropriate way to store your long-term wealth.
You think?
And, I have a little story I want to share.
Yes, sir.
So coming up on my birthday, August 15th of this year, there's going to be an auction of the finest known 1913 Liberty Nickel. And I've traced this coin back to 1948, where dealer Abe Kossoff sold it to a Baltimore beer maker named Louis Eliasberg Sr. He's the only individual to ever have completed collecting every single American coin ever issued.
Really?
Louis Eliasberg, yeah. And Kossoff offered him this coin for $2,350, which I imagine was a mountain of money in 1948. But he said, I've seen this coin and I think it's the finest known. Mm-hmm. And so he bought it and he kept it. And along the way, of course, he added a bunch of others till finally he successfully bought every single American coin ever made. And first and only man to ever do it. First and only person to ever do it, excuse me. So then I watched at 1996, a Bowers and Marina auction in May. Louis Eliasberg's collection was offered to the general public.
Yeah.
And this coin became the first coin ever to sell for over $1 million at auction. It sold for $1,485,000. Now, this was in May of 1996.
1996, right? $1.4 million. And this is a
1913 nickel.
Nickel. $1.4 million.
Well, almost 1.5. Let's not forget the 1.485.
Okay, well, let's just call five.
Call it 1.5.
Okay.
And you would think that was all the money in the world. Yeah. So the person that bought it held it for a few years. In March 2001, sold it to the sports agent Dwight Manley for $1,840,000.
Good for him.
Now Dwight, he kept it for a few years and sold it in 2004 for $3 million.
Really?
To a coin dealer. Who sold a private treaty a year later for $4,150,000.
What's a private treaty?
Meaning no auction. Hey, they met, he showed the coin, stuck his hand out, I'll take it, $4.15 million. Private treaty.
Nice.
Yeah. So now it's coming up for sale again. And I think this time it's going to break the $10 million record. It's like, where did this coin go? Well, where it went was really curious. A Southern California collector, who no one knew at the time, is a gentleman named Dr. Morton Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And he had inherited an antique desk from his great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And he was searching around the desk and found a hidden compartment that contained all of the other nickels, except that one. So he figured, you know what, this is an intergenerational coin collection. So over the next few decades, he bought every nice coin he could get his hands on.
Hmm.
And then the gentleman passed away. So the Morton Smith family has offered his coins now for sale at this auction. And man, I think it's just going to set all the records in the world. So if you're anywhere around Philadelphia between August 14th
and 18th. You're not going to go, are you?
Yeah. You think? I'll be there. No question about it. I got to see this because I already related the story a few weeks ago of the Utah billionaire who's decided that he wanted to do what Eliasberg.
Every coin ever.
Every coin. And in order for him to do it, he's got to have this coin. And I also know of two other collectors who want this coin. So that's very bad. When three people want the same thing and all of them have billions of dollars, a few million between those guys is not going to make a difference. I think the rest of the room is just going to stand there with their mouth hanging open as these three fight it out to see who's going to pay the most for this coin. And I expect it will be the first $10 million public auction coin.
Really? It's going to go, you think, from 2004, $4 million to $10
million? Yeah.
And that's simply because
supply and
people
demand.
Want it.
Yeah. There's only three that are collectible. Of the five that were made, one is in the National Numismatic Collection at the Smithsonian, and the other is in the collection of the American Numismatic Association, of which I'm a proud life member. So the third coin sold to a private collector in 2013 And it was the lowest of them all in terms of condition. It sold for $3.2 million. So now here we have the finest, single finest known of the rarest coin and the most legendary coin. It's going to bring $10 million. It's destined.
Isn't it crazy that it can have that kind of a value?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the holder that the coins were kept in sold for $10,000. Just just a little leather wallet, you know. Oh, I can't own the coin, so really? Let me just hold the leather wallet that it was stored in.
Man. Yeah, it's just fascinating to think of the motives behind this, but I guess when you got that kind of money, you just want something that nobody else has, I guess.
Yeah,
that's part of it. That's part of it.
That's
isn't
exactly.
It?
You
what are you going to do with
want
all this money,
when no right? one else can own.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think the Utah billionaire pointed out, there is no better store of value. He's enamored with these rare coins, and that's how it happens. He started out as a small-time coin collector and then made his billions doing real estate developing. And now wants to spend his money. What's he going to spend it on? Well, it's apparently going to be the finest coin collection assembled in the 21st century.
Well, you've kind of built your whole model, your company, and your life upon this idea, as you understand fiat currencies and derivatives and mortgage-backed securities and whatever, all this nonsense that they do
sure.
with play money,
right.
that you've always felt that real American money is... it's just not going to go south.
That's right.
I mean, it just can't, really. I mean, it could. I guess anything's possible.
Right.
But, I mean, there's just only so many of it. And you like it better than buying a hunk of gold because of the rarity?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you have a hunk of gold and you want to sell it...
Yeah, you get $1,300 an ounce.
That's it. Yeah. You know, like, you can't ask $1,400. Nobody will buy it. They can get it anywhere else for $13. So, in the case of this Libnickel... If you want it, you better be the high bidder, and you better like buy it now because you're not going to get another chance. You know, it's 5 to 10 years between auctions. So
yeah.
I think it's going to bring record prices. We'll see.
Are you going to be bidding there? You have $5 million you don't know what to do with?
No.
No, I don't think so.
Nah,
it's a lot.
It's out of my pay range.
Yeah, boy,
yeah.
It's above my pay grade a little bit. Mm-hmm. Wow. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. Come in and join us. Here's an email. Andrew has talked many, many times on behalf of Audit the Fed. In his opinion, who is the USA institution entity who could potentially audit the Fed, the New York Fed, and the other members of the Federal Reserve System? And second part, does Andrew know who is auditing the ECB, the Central Bank of Russia, and the Central Bank of China?
Well, the answer to those is no one. The answer to the first question would be either the GAO, General Accounting Office, or the Treasury Inspector General, one or the other, and both. So I don't think you'll ever see an audit of the Fed, however. Those folks have cherished their privacy for as long as they've had their charter. And every effort, the most recent, almost successful one in 2008, led by Congressman Ron Paul, sought to audit the Fed. And, of course, the financial crisis gave a lot of reason for them to do so. But still, in the face of that, the Fed maintained its independence and came out on the other side stronger than they were. So, to me, their power is cemented in such a way that I don't think any audit of the Fed is going to ever be successful in passing Congress.
Well, you've taught us that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is owned by all kinds of big banks, right?
Sure.
The usual suspects, the Goldman Sachs and Citi and HSBC and Wells Fargo and New York Mellon, you know, the boys, right? The banks.
Right.
So it's a private bank. For someone to go in, you can't really force an audit unless, I guess Treasury or somebody or, I don't know, maybe a... investigator if they suspected fraud.
Maybe Mueller could go in there. I don't know.
If they said you're committing fraud, but they're not really.
Well, here's
they're
the
just
reality.
Banking, right? It's legal.
The Fed is extra jurisdictional. They have.
I beg your pardon?
Well, if you're running a business in America, like a bank, you're subject to IRS audit at the very least.
Yes, indeedy.
But since the Federal Reserve banks, get this, are exempt from income tax?
Oh. No, come on.
Oh,
no, they're not.
They are
they're
specifically
not.
Exempt.
No, no, you're just making that up.
No,
you,
I wish
you
I
you mean to tell me that...
No matter what they earn, and they're guaranteed...
That Golden Mice Slacks and Wells Fargo and Citi, they don't pay income tax?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve Bank of New York...
Oh, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York...
...is exempt from income tax.
You think?
Yeah. Its owners, J.P. Morgan... Goldman and the others, they're entitled to a 6% dividend,
right?
Guaranteed. That's tax free. So the money that that Goldman earns from its ownership in the Federal Reserve, it pays no income tax on those profits.
Mm-hmm.
They're exempt from taxation. So the IRS can't audit them, the Federal Reserve. It would have to be an act of Congress. And either the GAO or the Inspector General. Not very likely.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah.
Sweet deal if you can get it.
Ooh, baby.
Many people have accused me of being jealous. And I admit I am. I mean, you know, 6% dividend guaranteed on paid up capital, tax free. Wow. What a deal.
And that's after expenses.
Of course.
Of course. And that means that anything is possible.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you could ship a pallet of $100 bills to some tin horn dictator, you know, that the CIA puts in an order form or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody would ever know.
No, they wouldn't.
And it's been done. We know that. Yeah. I mean, you know, where does this stuff come from?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, where do these $100 bill pallets come from?
Yeah, they come from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
They got to, right?
Yeah.
You know, and where do they come from?
Yeah.
Indeed.
Simply created out of thin air, as they like to say.
And then, of course, with no water, you'd have no way, right? You have no way.
That's right. We have no way of knowing. Now, in the crisis of 2008, we did get a look at 3 months of transactions between the Fed and its trading partners, and it revealed some pretty nasty stuff.
I remember. Yeah.
But... Look how much of a splash. I would say Stormy Daniels made a bigger splash than that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Come on. Yeah,
people, you know, even the most ardent audit the Fed guys failed to seize upon this as evidence of that fraud that you speak of.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they just let it go by. It was amazing to me. I mean, I was picking through it like it was a fine dinner, and they were... Just ignoring it. I never heard another thing about it. Have you? Have you ever heard anyone?
No. And you're talking about trillions, right?
Yeah. Trillions.
Remember the day when they moved a trillion and nobody knew about it?
Yeah, nobody knows.
I remember that day. You came on the air and said, well, there's something not right here.
There's something weird here on this balance sheet. $1 trillion just showed up overnight. I don't know where it came from. Yeah, well, and you could expect more of these types of monetary surprises as we move forward. Quite honestly, I'm shocked that we've gone as deep into it as we have without some massive rise in the price of commodities. Now, I see oil is, of course, leading the way, and inflation is bumping above that 2% target that the Fed set. So probably, I'm a year late already, so I think by midsummer, though, it should be obvious to everyone that inflation is imminent.
Mm-hmm. 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. As if we don't have enough fun stuff to talk about gold in my slacks. A recent Goldman Sachs report reveals the company is questioning whether or not curing chronic illnesses is compatible with a sustainable business model. What?
Yeah.
Is curing patients a sustainable business model?
No, I don't think it is. Keeping them sick is most certainly.
That's right. To deliver one-shot cures is one of the most attractive aspects of genetically engineering, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, if you just look at the numbers, you know, it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is why they're not going to do it, right?
Yeah, curing people's not a good business model.
No.
You want to keep them sick. That's a good business model.
Isn't that amazing that they actually put this on paper?
Well, nobody read it, but the financial ones.
Guys like me, you know. Or I got this from Green Med Info, so who reads that, you know?
Well, I think if people realize that keeping folks ill is a business for profit, then they'll realize, or they'll understand why so many of the things that we consume will hurt us.
A business. It's a business.
It's a business.
Man, it's a business. And boy, they've got this model locked up since I think it was what you talk about, the Houston Mullins book, Murder by Injection, and the mm-hmm. Rockefeller. And we had a lady on from Guadalajara, Dr. Nancy Banks, talked about that chilling stuff, about this whole reductionist molecular biology model. And it's just wrong. It's just, you know, it's like, it's just wrong. The math is wrong. The whole, it's all based on a bad model. Isn't it crazy? I mean, what is a healthcare thing? $2-3 trillion. It's massive. And it's just based on bad science.
Yeah.
Bad science. Wow. Man.
Well, I hear, of course, good science, like the dangers of glyphosates, right?
Oh, huge.
Right?
Huge.
We know by now.
Huge.
But it's like everything has it in it. It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. You know, they're using glyphosates, Andrew, now on non-GMO crops. So, you know, if you just go into a store and you get a something that
Non-GMO.
It's not organic, but it's just a blop. It's just there. They're using glyphosates to dry out the crop so it's easier for them to harvest it, right?
Yep.
Talked to a lady yesterday. She's been looking at wildlife. Her husband's a game warden. She's in the business. This is what she does. She has a whole program. She's been working with Stephanie Seneff. She's just put out her latest book. She's been doing this 25 years. And you can see with pictures, definitely see the effects of the glyphosates on the deer, on the birds, on the buffalo, on the horses, malformed mouths. It's just crazy. And they know it's a glyphosate because they can see the increase, you know, with the glyphosate. And the glyphosate comes in over the mountain there or where she, in the county where she is. And you know that the deer and the buffalo, lots of them do not even have correct male genitalia.
Hmm.
Huh? Just, they can't even make babies if they wanted to.
Jeez.
You know, they either have one testicle or none, or it's just, this is bad stuff, man. It's bad stuff.
Yeah.
Really.
Something like 250 million pounds of glyphosate.
Oh, much more. I think it's eight. I have the notes here. I think it's 800. I have the notes here we put in our show page. I think it's 800 million, billion. It's just nuts. So I wonder, knowing what you know about the boys and the government and the FDA and the USDA, and do you think that juggernaut will ever get cracked? I mean,
oh no!
I mean, what would it take?
That is fascism, right? The corporate state, uh-huh. where the corporations mm-hmm. Sort of own the government that's regulating them. Who's gonna make war with this beast?
Really is fascism, right? The corporation running the government.
Correct.
So, yeah. Like you would have ADM or Monsanto or Merck or all these people really calling the shots.
That's right.
With whatever you got, right?
That's right.
Whether it be GMOs or whatever, vaccines or whatever.
And now Monsanto and Bayer are merging, right?
Yeah, right.
So
huge.
Now, Bayer is the former IG Farben. Look at the history of Bayer, and I think...
So spooky, man. You know,
As long with the history of Monsanto.
Is it?
So, as I loosely term the boys, this is... Uh-huh. This is fascism. The late Aaron Russo wanted to characterize our government as a fascist government, mm-hmm. and he caught a lot of resistance. He has filmed From Freedom to Fascism, mm-hmm. sort of went to great lengths to point out how this was a fascist government, and I think he was correct.
So I need to watch that. That's 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah, he's passed long before.
But that was the... film he put out, Freedom to Fascism.
Yeah, From Freedom to Fascism.
So was he talking about the whole corporate thing?
Yeah, he was. Now, you know, Aaron Russo was not some independent filmmaker. He's the guy who did The Rose with Bette Midler and Trading Places with Eddie Murphy.
Great movie, yeah.
So money wasn't his problem. He could afford to make a first-class movie, whether or not it was viable, right?
Sure.
And he did.
He did.
And the movie's title is From Freedom to Fascism.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think it's a wonderful look at how corporations have ingratiated themselves, even worse, with state and federal regulatory authorities. And they do it in every manner. So
everywhere, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you talk about the natural milk farmers that are, you know, being raided with guns drawn for selling raw milk.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sort of enforcement activity that the government pursues on behalf of the corporations that are being harmed. So, you know, you got a guy selling raw milk. We don't sue him. We're just going to send the feds in to snatch his entire operation, yeah, put him out of business, and then he's no longer a competitive threat.
We don't need that kind of competition.
That's, right. Yeah. That's fascism. So
that's fascism. So why are the globalists calling President Trump a fascist? It's just a good name.
Yeah, it is a good name.
It's just a good name. Because it really kind of gets your attention, right?
That's right, yeah. People call him that don't even understand the meaning of the term.
Mm-hmm.